My name is Joel Nickel. I'm a parish pastor. I've been a parish pastor for 28 years. I serve a parish in Staten, Oregon. I'm also an artist. I've been interested in the visual arts, that goes way, way back, even before I was a parish pastor. And of course, part of my concern is to let theology talk to aesthetics as well as vice versa, and to see if we can enrich the life of the church through visual arts. And then also bring some theological sensitivity to the visual arts, so it goes both ways. I've titled this session, Make the Hidden Visible, and I'm taking a clue from a quote from Paul Klee, who I put in the expressionistic camp, and I will really talk about Paul Klee more next week. But he said that the role of art is not to render the visible, but to render visible. If you take the little word the out of the first part of that quotation, you get what he was hitting at. It is the role of art to reveal what is hidden, to get under the surface of things, because that's where the dynamics of life really lie. It in part is a romantic point of view, but it says that the role of art is the to bring some revelation of the human condition, of inward struggles, of the realities of life that lie beneath the surface, that we say, you know, man looks on the outward person, but God looks on the heart. I think the expressionistic artists are trying to look on the heart of the matter, and that they find the wellsprings for creativity from within themselves. It's a sort of a gut level way of proceeding. I think before we can understand the Expressionists, we have to understand what they were up against. Certainly there are some predecessors in the style that we call Expressionism. The main one, who I will talk about a little bit more tomorrow, is Matthias Grunewald, who was a contemporary of Luther. He understood well the Gothic urge to express oneself from the core of one's being, rather than following some more classical kinds of inspiration and encouragement. I didn't bring the slides along, but there's a way of showing Grunewald's crucifixion compared to a crucifixion scene painted by an Italian in the classical tradition. The Italian painting of the crucifixion shows the cross of Christ standing in a beautiful landscape with a bay in the background with ships in it. Kind of saying that the crucifixion of Christ was one of the most natural kinds of things that ever happened. It fits into the landscape. Whereas when Grunewald goes to paint the crucifixion scene, it's terror. It's obviously suffering. It is a horrendous scene. It is not pretty. It is something that galvanizes one's spirit to react to it. It's not an image that you'd want to put on your living room wall, because you can't live with it very easily. The classical, and I just want to kind of give you a thumbnail sketch of the aesthetic motivation in back of the classical artists. They're drawing on Plato and Aristotle. Actually, Aristotle's aesthetics he derives from Plato. They were both of the opinion that a role of an artist was to imitate, the word they used was mimic, nature. Mimic what they saw, because, and this was in a sense removed, a step removed from the ideal. Plato said that there's an ideal realm of which the real is only a faint imitation. And the role of the artist was to imitate the real world, but in idealistic forms. We do the same thing in our beauty pageants in the United States. We look for the ideal 10, the perfect figure. And then if we get that, every once in a while you see posters of Marilyn Monroe. I wonder, had Marilyn Monroe not committed suicide, what she would look like today. Mm-hmm. Probably had to have plastic surgery and all the like. There is an aging process that goes on that the classical ideal wants to deny. Ernst Becker, in his book, The Denial of Death, points that up, that the role of classical art is to say there is some permanence amid all the realistic change that we notice among us. And if that kind of classical art is put in the service of tyrannical governments, it becomes an oppressive thing. Hitler tried to do that in the Third Reich. The reason why Hitler hates these expressionist artists and saw them as a threat was because they were hinting of the impermanence of things and the importance of one's life struggles. And this world that we live in is passing away. It has it's marked by frailty, and yet in the middle of all of this, there is still hope. My subhead asks the question, and this is maybe grounds for debate after we watch the slides, is Expressionism the Lutheran style? And I might caution you from misunderstanding what I'm saying. I don't think that the Church baptizes any artistic style and says this is closer to God than some other style. But as I understand Lutheran theology, as I understand Luther, Luther was very caught up with the internal struggles of coming to faith, of finding a gracious God. Luther was of a not really ambivalent estimate of anthropology, but when Luther looked at human beings, he saw them as simul justus et peccator, that Latin phrase that we so often use, meaning human beings are at the same time justified and sinful. And I think of that little equation, the important word is the word simul, at the same time. It's not that human beings can achieve a righteousness in which they are no longer sinful, or that they are forever condemned to be sinful and fall far short of righteousness. The righteousness of God given to the sinner is always an alien righteousness. It comes from outside of us. It comes from God as a gift. But that gives us new status. This is the Pauline theme of justification. We stand before God not on the basis of our own righteousness, but on the basis of an alien righteousness imparted to us by Christ. That is a very expressionistic way of understanding human struggle, the struggle of faith and our standing before God. Maybe have I been clear so far, or am I leaving some strings uncovered?
When you explain Luther, how that you're tying it in with architecture, maybe I just had a lapse of attention.
I'm tying it in with art. Luther, the Lutheran tradition, this became apparent yesterday when everyone went to the musical offering rather than the visual art offering, for some good reasons. That in the Lutheran tradition, whenever these two art forms come up against each other, music always wins hands down. Because in the Lutheran tradition, visual arts are what we would call in Latin adiaphora. That Latin word means something that is neither commanded nor forbidden, is a matter of indifference. Something that's neither commanded or forbidden in the scriptures is a matter of indifference. That means that you are free to use it or not use it, and no one stands in judgment of you. When Luther was an outlaw, when he had to go into hiding in the castle, He stayed there for a whole year, but what brought him back out to Wittenberg? It was the iconoclastic movement that was underway already, led by Karlstadt, who was removing all the statues. They were breaking stained glass windows. They were taking all of the visual art out of the church that reminded them of Catholicism. Catholicism, still to this day, is very interested in visual art, and usually in the classical mode, I might add. Luther put a stop to this. He said that these visual artifacts are adiaphora. They're neither commanded nor forbidden. So you're right in saying that to draw the connection between Luther and an art form is really difficult to do. And so the connection is not explicit, but it's implicit. I'm just asking the question, is expressionism as an art form closer to Lutheran theology than maybe some other art styles that are out there? I think I know the answer, but I'm not going to impose this on anyone else. So, the connection is not, we're not able to make it explicitly, but it may be implicit. What happens in the Reformation is that you have these three artists that are very, very prominent. Albrecht Dürer, Matthias Grunewald, and Lucas Cranach, who is the portrait painter of Wittenberg. If you go to the Luther Museum in Wittenberg, which was the old Augustinian cloister where Luther lived, the East Germans turned this into a museum of the Reformation, and they always call Luther the man with the hammer. And of course, that fit in with the Russian emblem or the Soviet emblem. But they looked at Luther for his revolutionary activities. Well, it's in this same museum now that you can see these paintings done by Lucas Cranach of Luther at various stages of his life, as well as his wife and his children. So there were these three prominent artists that art did figure in closely with the Reformation. Albrecht Dürer did an about-face. He was in the Roman Catholic classical camp and became much more affected by the Reformation. He was, of course, older than Luther, and so it was not an easy change that he went through. Grunewald, we don't know much about him as an individual. The suspicion is that he got involved in one of the peasant rebellions, and we don't hear much from him. He may have died in that kind of a rebellion. But what happens in the next generation after these three painters is that visual arts don't become important anymore, because the word, which was so important for Luther, is carried by the vehicle of music. And that's why I said before that when the visual arts and music are these two art forms that compete in Lutheran circles, music wins hands down, because it's a much easier vehicle to carry the word, which Luther was interested in proclaiming and getting out to the people. Visual arts can be rather confusing when it comes to the word, because they're tied to the images and line and color and shape and form that the artist uses. It's very, very subjective. Visual arts are subjective. The music and the proclamation of the word is much more objective.
Oh, but didn't the Catholics did use a lot of those, like on the one in Venice, the St. Mark's, they mm-hmm. have these colonnades with the whole story of a life of a man, a Christian. First he's born, baptized, raised, married, he has children. They put it there visually. Didn't they use that as visual arts because people couldn't read?
Correct. Yeah, and the other thing that's happening in the Reformation Germany is that the 16th century in Germany begins with a literacy rate of 7% of the population could read and write. The 16th century ends in Germany with the literacy rate up to about 60%. so that there's a fantastic explosion of people reading the Gospels in their native language, and Luther did that in his translations. And you know, this again fits into the problem that Lutherans have appreciating visual art, because we've always had it in verbal form. Let me just make a point quickly and take a question. There's a jump today that we need to be conscious of. I sat in on the one public session that Holden's Futurists led, talking about virtual realities and the fact that this is going to be a visual world that we live in, and Lutherans will need to compete in that visual electronic world. And so it's really vitally in our self-interest to pay more attention to the visual arts.
I'm wondering at the same time, I'm sure that's correct, but when you say you're talking about Lutherism, Luther being a Hebraist, doesn't he in a way reflect a deep ambiguity within the Christian tradition as a whole against images shared with Muslims and Jews? That there's something about an image that one needs to be suspicious of. And so that and Lutherans in particular, aren't maybe necessarily idiosyncratic in this, but there's kind of a deep suspicion that goes way back to the Second Commandment. About this as well.
This was the session that was not held yesterday that I was talking a little bit about this, the tradition of the use of icons and then iconoclasm and how you get out of that. The one thing I think that saves the Lutheran tradition is that we follow the Roman Catholics when it comes to the Ten Commandments, Luther's catechism. The one commandment that you don't find is you shall not make for yourself a graven image. It's subsumed under the first commandment. Whereas if you in Reformed circles, you have that commandment. Lutherans fudge at the end of the Ten Commandments when we have these two commandments about coveting kind of at the end. So we obviously don't have the right numbering system.
Right. However, like the Jews do.
Right, yeah. Right. However, because I think that's fortunate for us, if you read contemporary writers that are dealing with aesthetics and theology out of the Reformed tradition, they spend half their book, you know, Nicholas Wardershoff, I think that's his name, Art in Action is the title of his book, spends half that book kind of defending the use of images. You know, Lutherans at least don't have to start at that point. We follow the Roman Catholic tradition in the West of seeing that images are well used for the purposes of indoctrination, of telling the story to illiterate people, and we have no trouble using the visual arts as visual aids. But I think that the visual arts are more than just visual aids. They are a form of communication all on their own. And maybe at that point, so that we can get through these slides, I've got about 50 of them, if we can get started and just turn on the machine and turn off the lights. Gary, right in back of you. I'd like to start with George Rouault, who is a French artist at the turn of the century, paints this picture that he calls Fugitives. George Rouault was trained as a stained glass artist, and in the way in which he paints, if you've seen any of his paintings up close, you see how thickly he lays on the pigment. He goes over and over and over again. It's a very heavy kind of image. The use of black in the paintings of George Rouault give it its existential sense. The subtitle of this, which he called Fugitives, is also Exodus. So Rouault is thinking in a biblical sense of the pain, the struggle of being fugitive and on an exodus. This is called The Flight into Egypt, and I'm not even sure that at first glance you can determine where the figures are. Obviously, for Rouault, color carries the message. It's very, very meaningful. The reds here are imply some kind of stress, some kind of turmoil. much more familiar image then is Christ being mocked. Rouault painted this in 1932. If you can remember what the storm clouds were beginning to gather in Europe at that time. So that too heightens the existential kind of circumstance that bring this out. Rouault has a whole series of paintings in the passion narratives of Jesus. Another painting titled Christ Mocked. You can see in the white sections already the cracks that are developing in the pigment, because the pigment is laid on so thick. Very much involved kind of process of the painter laying down pigment onto a canvas surface. Move on to a painting by Emil Noldi. Noldi is an interesting person. Noldi was a Nazi. Yeah, he was part of the National Socialist Party, and until they booted him out and declared him a degenerate artist. And so Noldi, I think he was rather a naive person. He was at first attracted by the nationalism or the importance of getting Germany as a nation back on its feet. But Noldi was also influenced by primitive art. This is where I go back to my question about can the word primitive be used in a positive sense? Because what Noldi and some other artists that we'll soon see found in primitive art was an exuberance, it was a vitality that they no longer saw in the bourgeois culture of their age. And so they were attracted by what they saw. This is titled Dance Around the Golden Calf. And it, what we see as the horror of idolatry in that story, Noldi saw as there was something attractive to this. It was kind of on the edge of what was permitted, over the edge, and it was a very primitive kind of happening. Stravinsky's Rite of Spring comes to mind when you see this painting. What is this painting making visible? Respond to it.
The center is the baby, of course.
Okay, center is the baby. Is that a pretty baby? Blonde, blue eyed?
Just like a newborn.
Newborn. Kind of real, right? It's not an idealized figure. Mary and Joseph, what are they like? What comes to mind? Yeah, maybe gypsies. I think that's what Rouault would Noldi would have as a reference point. Peasants, definitely. I like the donkey, kind of keeping eye on things. You get a sense of the connectedness of nature, the star, sun, the stars up in the sky, the shepherds in the distance coming. There's a connection here, and the baby is the center of it all. This is the other part of the Christmas gospel. It is the adoration of the Magi, along with all the little cherubs in the background. Again, is this a beautiful picture? No, not really. Is it a powerful picture? Yeah. Yeah, and the kind of the smile of Mary. Part of primitive art is their use of masks, and so there is a mask-like quality, I think, to some of these faces. The Woman Taken in Adultery is the title of this painting. There is a prohibition, I think, among classical artists of really portraying a person of this place in society. Later on, Picasso will make a lot out of that. Doubting Thomas. What do you make of the figure of Jesus? Red hair. Have you ever seen a red-headed Christ?
Never.
Okay. What does that say? Okay, that's a good point. He's an international figure. He's not blonde and blue-eyed. Werner Solomon's head of Christ would be the opposite, the very opposite aesthetically of that image.
It's the same kind of as his side piece and his hands, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Noldy likes the color yellow for flesh. You know, the Crayolas, they finally removed the flesh color, which was kind of a pink, and they no longer supply that in your box of crayons if you go out to buy them. Finally admitting the fact that there are a variety of skin colorations in the world.
Is there any reason, Joel, for the reddish tint on the figure on the right, you know,
in the back? Okay. Yeah. No, nothing that I have discovered. Again, the point is, this is not an idealized kind of picture. And the impulse, I think, in churches, we want to idealize Jesus, don't we? You know, he is the ideal man, the ideal Adam, and we put him up on a pedestal. But Noldy didn't.
The ideal for people who are Spanish or black people or Asian, he's ideal for Caucasians. And
yeah.
blonde Caucasians, not even brunette ones.
Right.
I think the one who idealize it, that is so prominent in religious bookstores is just a lie. It's not.
Yeah, that's right. It's what I call visual heresy. And there's a lot of that in the church because we haven't paid attention to visual art. There's a lot of visual heresy in our churches. We're moving on to another artist, George Grosz. He was a German artist who was radicalized in World War I, fought in the trenches, and is reacting to that kind of a world, painting this urban scene in reds. He calls this Metropolis. Again, it's not a flattering picture of the advancing urban technology that people at that time were so proud of. The Lovesick Man is another George Grosz image. What happens to the perspective in this painting? Is it an orderly world? Yeah, the tendency in 20th century art is to flatten everything into just two dimensions. That's one thing that happens. Both, and right under the heart is what? A gun, a revolver. Is this lovesick man going to take his life? Is this a potential suicide? This is a very suicide was one of those existential questions that expressionist theater often dealt with, and it's unsettling. Another George Grosz painting. I like the clergyman down in the lower left with his hands upraised. It's the opposite of the happy face. Just a kind of a round disc, but he's not smiling, and yet raising the cross. Above him, Heute Tanz Christa is the daily dance. Heute Tanz, right? Today's dance, over the door, right there. This is what's going on day by day, kind of under the surface of reality. Everybody sees things as being rather placid, and you know, if you go to New York today, certainly there's a lot of traffic and people are coming and going. But if you really look under the surface of things, it is a time for fear. There's a whole lot of stress. And indeed, in the years that George Grosz painted this painting, this was right in the aftermath of World War I. There was certainly an upheaval going on in German society that the artist was able to take a look at honestly. Carl Schmidt-Rottluff, is the artist, and this is called The Kiss of Judas. Here is where an artist has discovered primitive art, African masks to be specific, and is portraying Judas and the Christ in that style. What had happened in the late 19th century is that Germany led the way in developing anthropological museums. And so these German Expressionist artists spent a lot of time in the anthropological museum studying the art of primitive cultures, and came away saying there is much more freedom in the primitive culture, at least that's the way they read it, than they found in their bourgeois world, and there is much more vitality and power and strength. The sense of the spiritual pervades everything in primitive cultures. And they were reacting against the process of secularization in their culture. Lord, depart from me. That's Peter down in the lower right-hand corner with his hands outstretched, and they've just caught so many fish that the boats sank. The fishermen are in the nude, which was the way they really fished in Palestine. The Bible alludes to Peter having to put on his clothes after the resurrection when he sees Jesus standing on the shore and diving into the lake because they fished in the nude. But there is Jesus standing, obviously a figure of holy presence. And how is he portrayed? Not again in the classical Greek kind of sculpture as this ideal God who is now in human form, but again using the style of primitive art. He's rooted to the earth. He's down to earth. Again, the woman caught in adultery. This figure crops up time and again among the German Expressionists. The forgiving love of Jesus that turned people around was a power. If you can look at her accusers on the left, pointing to her, again, Jesus is portrayed in a different way. He doesn't have a beard, doesn't have long flowing hair, but reaches out and touches the woman. Pharisees is the title of this painting. There's a plot going on, plot against Jesus, that Schmidt Rutloff puts his finger on in 1912, just in the just before World War I gets started. Expressionism really flowered right before the war, and of course there are people that debate, you know, just what is expressionism, who's in that movement and who's out, what, when does it begin, when does it end, and you kind of have to have the broader view and the narrow view. The narrow view is that expressionism flowers, it just kind of explodes right before World War I, and that by the end of the war, artists are moving on to what Otto Dix called the new subjectivity, the new objectivity, the painting the real world without emotional content. This is titled The Road to Emmaus. It's one of my favorite graphic works that comes out of the German Expressionist movement. Again, Jesus is not a bearded figure standing in the middle. The two disciples walking that he's walking with are stooped over in their sorrow and self-concern. And Jesus looks right at us with his eyes wide open. This is a sort of a consciousness-raising graphic. There's power in these images that is very attractive. Again, it challenges your definition of beauty. Ernst Barlach is a favorite artist. He is really a sculptor, and so this is a kind of a preliminary woodcut to a sculpture This is hovering God the Father, and here it's this piece is called The First Day of Creation.
A lot of William Blake in there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the seventh day of creation. I love this one. The God's sitting back and saying, it's good.
That's right. Before and after.
Now, there's a whole series. He does one of these woodcuts for each day of creation. And these woodcuts are occasions for some of his sculpture. The year of our Lord, 1918. And I take that as kind of a Satan figure in the on the right-hand part of the picture, kind of saying, what difference have you made, Jesus? It's 1,918 years after your birth, and they're still killing each other. And on the upper right-hand corner, you see little rows of crosses just covering the landscape. This is what happened in the First World War, that you have these multiple crucifixions. And Satan really saying, Jesus, have you made any difference? The expressionists want to take war seriously, human cruelty, what we do to one another. And there is always a prophetic element in the expressionists. This is a Barlock sculpture, The Lame Man. It was designed to go into a niche on the front facade of a church in Liebeck, Katharinenkirche. This sculpture is in place now. We were in Liebeck last summer, and I didn't bring that slide along. I should have done that, of it in place. But after Barlock had designed these niches, he worked with an architect designing the niches. He was going to do the sculpture that goes in the exterior front facade of the church. The Nazis caught up with him. Barlock was banned from teaching, from exhibiting. His paintings, his sculptures were removed from churches, museums. They even kicked him out of his house that he had built himself because they said he didn't fill out the correct building permits. Barlock died in 1938 before World War II gets started, a broken man. Katie Kollwitz, I don't have any of slides of her work in this, but she is part of the German Expressionist movement, has a beautiful drawing, I think it's charcoal, of Ernst Barlock on his deathbed. He lies as a withered, emaciated, sunken man, but on his chest are his hands that are crossed, and they're obviously the hands of a sculptor. They are strong and vital. So that even in his death, the work of Barlock lives on in Katie Kollwitz's estimation. Even Hitler couldn't do him in. The point of this is the reason why Hitler hated this kind of art was because this wasn't the art of the master race. If you had to portray the master race, what kind of images would you use? You'd go back to some of the classical figures again. The Nazis had a show of degenerate art, is what they called it. And they had all these expressionist artists on display. This next sculpture, this is Jesus and Thomas, Doubting Thomas. This was part of the degenerate art exhibit, and it was roundly satirized and made fun of by the Nazis. This is your savior. Look what Barlock does to your savior. You know, he belittles him. Jesus is kind of like a cripple, a weakling. You want a savior who is strong and almighty and perfect. I saw this statue not only in the Degenerate Art Show, which was a traveling exhibit just a year ago, 2 years ago, but there's a Barlock sculpture of this in Germany too. Max Pechstein is an artist that Hitler banned, and he did this woodcut series on the Lord's Prayer. Our daily bread give us today is the German. Unser täglich Brot gib uns heute. The Expressionists recovered an art form that really had been lost or not much used since the time of the Reformation, and that was the art form of the woodcut. If any of you have done any woodcuts or linoleum cuts, know that there's a lot of physical activity that goes into carving the plate from which this is printed. It's really a hands-on, very existential kind of process of gouging into the wood and removing bits and pieces so that they don't print, and then inking the wood and then putting the paper down and pressing it and pulling off the image. It's really a hands-on artistic process. And of course it becomes very expressive. The German Expressionists of the 20th century recovered the woodcut as an art medium. And Pechstein's, these are actually fairly large. They must be at least 18 by 24 inches, if not larger than that. And so there was a lot of work that went into this. Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. Lead us not into temptation. It's not quite in focus. Again, the primitive influences are in the background. Walter Hobdunk did not make it into the classification degenerate artist, and mainly because I think he's working after World War II. Krista, are you familiar with his work? I don't know much about Walter Hobdunk, except that this is the call of Abraham. I should maybe ask you to guess what's going on here. What are the predominant features of the figure?
Hands.
Feet. And ears. Not maybe so much on this, but God is getting Abraham's attention, and he's going to use his feet in the upcoming years and his hands. Who's this? Who's holding up the prophet's hands? Holding up Moses' hands while Israel is in battle. Okay, look at those hands. Kind of a small figure, but this is a woodcut, and you can tell kind of the expression that flows through this figure.
You've got six hands here?
There are two figures in back of Moses. Moses, two hands, and then two figures, in back of Moses. Aaron, who had to hold up Moses' hands? I think Aaron did, and anybody else? He's maybe taking liberties with the text for graphic reasons.
Was it his wife?
Miriam?
Miriam.
Miriam? Uh-huh. But again, the kind of the beseeching eyes, a very human portrait, even though it's not naturalistic. It's very real without being naturalistic, if you can make that distinction. The classical art loves the natural. I've got a friend back in our congregation. They've got a house perched atop the Santiam River, and as she says, it takes a lot of work to keep it looking natural. And I always like that phrase because it really puts the finger on the difference between the real and the natural. The real happens. That's what is. The natural is how we try to work with the real. They want it to be look like a natural forest, but they put a lot of work into transplanting and fertilizing and watering, and so it's no longer real. It's not really real, but it's very natural and it looks beautiful. That's kind of like this painting. This is very real, but it's not natural. I once used this image, this was years ago at campus ministry, to do a super graphics of this. I don't know if you've ever done super graphics, but borrowing Walter Hobdunk's image of Bethlehem, we took this little woodblock print that's maybe 6 by 9 inches and blew it up to 9 by 12 feet. And you can do that with the process called super graphics. And when you do that, this is a very, very powerful image. But again, the human focus on the connection between mother and child primarily, then the father and the donkeys. I like the smile of the donkeys. They are enjoying this scene immensely.
Yeah.
And the baby, beautiful eyes. I mean, it's
very expressive eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Powerful hands again. That becomes a trademark of Walter Hobdunk's art. Who's this guy up the tree?
Oh, yeah.
Zacchaeus. Yeah. Come on down on the ground, Zacchaeus. You can't live up a tree. Who's this?
Jonah.
Jonah in the belly of the fish. When we were in Lübeck last summer, the cathedral in Lübeck is doing something that all Lutheran churches should do. Sponsor an art show and open it up to everyone, not just people in the congregation, but people in the community, especially artists that you know, saying the theme is Jonah and the resurrection. And that's what this cathedral did. And they took all comers. Everybody who submitted art, their art was displayed. It was delightful. You know, the image that I remember was Jonah using the open mouth of the whale as his pulpit. You know, Jonah has to go to preach to Nineveh. And so they put those two images together. And so Jonah is preaching out of the mouth of the great fish. And if you think about the truth of that, what gives Jonah his experience of God? It's that great fish that swallows him. That's where his experience of God is formed. And it is out of that experience that he can do his preaching.
It's something humorous, like the backward look of the whale's eye. How's it going down there, Jonah?
Yeah, very good. There is humor in this, because humor is human.
And Jonah's also in a fetal position in that too.
Yeah, yeah. Are you finished with that? We can go back to that. We've got to keep moving on. We've got about 12 minutes yet. Okay, this was another artist that I was unfamiliar with until we went to Germany last year. Rudolf Behling is the sculptor's name. And he didn't, to my knowledge, do any biblically connected work. But his images are just astounding. Behind, you can't really tell this, but in the mouth and up behind right here and around the eyes, that's all hollow. There's nothing there. What projects is the lips, the mouth, and the lips are connected to the nose through a narrow piece right there. The nose goes up, and then this is it's inside outside. And talk about making the hidden visible and seeing beneath the surface of things. This is a self-portrait. Behling was in appearance very similar to this figure. It's called Mahogany Head, and it was sculpted in 1921. It made its way into Hitler's degenerate art exhibit. Here's another artist who was not portraying the master race, the ideal, the Nordic ideal, and gets condemned because of it. Again, the importance of the eyes. It's again a very real portrayal, but it's not natural. Helmut Uhrig I don't know much about this artist, but I like this image. This is the flight to Egypt. And what's going on in that demon that is devour, that almost wants to devour the angel who protects Mary and Joseph? It's the murder of the children of Bethlehem. I've never seen an artist put those two stories together. In fact, in our lectionary, we always tell the story of the flight into Egypt without the Kindermord zum Bethlehem. Was that the German? The murder of the children of Bethlehem. But again, talk about terror. How do you portray terror? You know, this expressionist artist kind of goes back to a very medieval Gothic image of the dragon.
How many of these artists were in any sense what you would call believers, or did they just take these themes from out of culture?
They were believers, maybe not in a church observant sense, mm-hmm. but they were believers. You can't look at their art without seeing the faith that's behind it. Mm-hmm. But it was not the faith that was shared by the nationalistic church that Hitler tried to control. This is an aside, I don't know if we have time for asides, but one of the things I was interested in, last summer I took a 3-month sabbatical and I went to Germany. I wanted to research the question, are there any churches that have expressionist art in them? Whether in liturgical art or in some kind of illustrations, or is there an expressionistic element to the architecture? And I found nothing. I went to the Center for the Study of Church Architecture and Contemporary Church Art at Marburg, in Marburg, at the university there, and they have a slide collection of all the churches in West Germany, interior and exterior shots.
Wow.
And I asked them, you know, point me to a church that has an expressionistic influence. And they gave me the names of two churches in Berlin. I found one of them, but it was locked.
Yeah.
On a Sunday, when there was a pastor who was scheduled to be there at 7 o'clock in the evening and never showed up, and there were about 4 or 5 of us waiting for him. Talk about the locked Lutheran churches of Germany, there was one. The other place was in East Berlin, and it was a former interrogation office used by the Nazis and then again by the Stasi that they are turning into a chapel. And Alfred Herdlicke, who is a contemporary German artist, kind of a neo-expressionist, has done the artwork there, but I didn't find that. So two places that they could point me where this art found its way into the churches. The churches are oblivious to this. I got to go back, I'm sorry. This is the prodigal son. You can see the pig forms around him. Up in the upper right-hand corner, I like that agricultural implement that you use to cut grass with, and it's up against his head. You see that? Mm-hmm. And talk about coming to the end of your rope. Mm-hmm. There's power in that image. This is Max Beckmann. Max Beckmann is one of the degenerate artists that Hitler doesn't like. This is The Night, painted in 1918 at the end of the First World War. Beckmann was a fairly classical painter until he fought in the trenches of World War I, and then he went on to kind of expose the sadistic way in which people treat people in our world. What goes on under the surface, the nice surface, the natural surface of life? This is Beckmann's view of what human beings do to human beings. When you read the newspaper and see what's on the front page, what's in back of that news, you know, the stories of rapes and murders and all of this. Artists who were expressionistic had this compulsion to make that scene visible. No longer do we sweep it under the rug. We make the hidden visible. And again, this is not an image that you can live with easily. And of course, Hitler didn't like it either. This is a famous Max Beckmann triptych. Triptychs are a 3-paneled painting. And they were done in churches, primarily, in the Middle Ages. This painting is not in a church. I'm sorry, it's out of focus on the edges. But again, on the edges, on the fringes, this again is the man's inhumanity to man. The figure beating the drum in the lower right-hand corner is a typical Beckman symbol for time. Time marches on. Time marches to the drummer. And in the center panel, I've read a Jungian analysis of this painting because the sea, the placid sea, is a very real symbol for the unconscious in psychological thought. Whether Beckman had that in mind or not, I don't know. Or this could be a mythological image, the Fisher King, or it could be a Christ figure. He's got his right hand raised in blessing. Is this the Sea of Galilee? Is, you know, what does this mean? And I can't answer that very Lutheran question. Because I don't know what was in Beckman's mind. I do know that he painted this in 32. He was under threat of arrest from the Nazis. He fled to Belgium and then came to the United States before World War II broke out. His work was collected by Morton D. May in St. Louis. Any of you come from the Midwest know the May department stores. And this is in the St. Louis Art Museum. Self-portrait. There's a new show in New York. I don't know if it's still up. Beckman self-portraits. And this was done in 38. His self-portrait with a horn. Blow the trumpet in Zion is a very prophetic kind of image in the Old Testament. And Beckman with his horn is blowing the alarm. That's 1938, that's how he sees himself, and because he's blown the alarm, he's got to leave Europe.
Did many of these guys anticipate a market for their paintings?
No. Although, you know, there were galleries and places that were investing in their art. What was interesting was that after the degenerate art show was over, Hitler and Goebbels, they put all these paintings out there on the national art market for sale because they needed money to buy their war arms. So much of this art was saved because people in Switzerland and England and the United States wanted to rescue this art from the hands of the Nazis and bought it up. Hitler needed money, and so that's what saved this. The Falling Man, this was a 1950 painting, one of the last paintings Beckman did before his death. He died in New York City. He had taught at Washington University in St. Louis in the late 40s. Again, we could go into this image, but we've got just a few minutes left, and I'm going to have to hustle.
Did he teach art?
Did what?
Did he teach
Yes,
art?
He did, at Washington University in St. Louis. is this Icarus? Is it human nature? What's going on here? I'm not quite sure. It's not a very hopeful picture, is it? Otto Dix is one of my favorite artists, and the last shots I'm going to show now are all produced by him. This is his war triptych. Again, it's in the style of an altar painting.